Thanks, Ellie, for the introduction. And yes, I am a master's student and I'm finishing my first year. They're usually here, I don't know how it works in Canada, but usually here in Brazil, a 2-year master's program, and I'm starting up now. I am from University of Campinas, and I've been doing some collab work with the people in the International Institute of Physics with Rafael Chavez, Jorge Agnetti. So this is actually, Ali asked me to talk about this paper that we put on archive. Actually, on archive is a different title. We changed it in a revised version, but the same paper. And it's a work by me, Davide Agnetti, Jorge, Lucas Feliceno, who's a PhD student here at the University of Campinas, Rafael Rabelo, who's my supervisor and professor. And yeah, let's get started.
Pedro, sorry to interrupt. The sound quality is not great. I think we can survive. Are you using your best microphone?
I can try to reconnect to see if it's better.
I'm just sometimes.
Can you guys hear me better now?
Sorry?
Can you guys hear me better now?
Yes, I think it. Do you agree, Ellie, that it's a bit better?
No, I think that the previous microphone was better. This sounds choppy to me.
Previous one?
This one's less muffled.
Okay, good.
This is much better than you.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Pedro.
So now it's okay?
Yes.
Okay. So let's get started. Just a heads up. If you guys have any questions throughout the presentation, I'd just rather you interrupt me. Like it's totally fine. Okay. And this is an overview of my talk. So first I'm gonna talk about in a general way, what were the main contributions of our manuscript. Then I'm going to try to explain them to you guys. I'm talk about the connections of the Evans scenario, which I'm going to present to you guys in a few minutes, with the instrumental, talk about a little bit of inflation technique, non-convex optimization for causal compatibility, which is our second main contribution. I'm going to make some comments on inflation and non-convex optimization. I'm going to present also some partial results that we had with some connections to the bilocal scenario, some theory independent constraints, and make some comments throughout that. And if there's time, I would like to make a comment on error correction as well. So let's start. First, I would like to start by just putting some names and notations and just to introduce the framework that we're working on. And I'm interested in network scenarios, and perhaps the most famous network we can talk about is the Bell scenario. And well, usually in the Bell scenario, you have two parts and each part has its possible choices of questions and they have some answers and they may share some statistical property between them. And well, that can be a particle or something like that. And what matters is that you can describe the probabilities of the outcomes given the questions that you are asking by the Born rule, and you observe correlation. And when you observe correlation, there's something called the Reichenbach principle that there's either a direct influence to explain that, so perhaps some communication between them, or there's a common cause that explains that correlation locally. And usually when we're talking about Bell scenarios, we are interested in the mismatch between quantum predictions and classical ones, because well, the experiment is done in such a way that there cannot be any communication between the parts. And then there's no influence on X to Y or like non-signaling conditions. And a common cause leads to a Bell inequality, which I put here just as an example, the CHSH, which is bounded by local hidden variable theories, and we can violate them with quantum mechanics. So that's that's interesting, because then if it cannot be a common cause and it cannot be some direct influence, we're kind of stuck. And from a causal inference point of view, we can see that Bell's theorem is just one particular experiment in which quantum correlations cannot be provided a classical causal explanation. So it's like a particular instance of causal inference in a more general sense. And well, in a few decades, like I think it's been less decade perhaps, the investigation of network non-locality has gone beyond the Bell scenario. So perhaps this doesn't really make a difference when we're talking about bipartite systems, because well, if you're a computer scientist, you might think that okay, the stochastic properties that the parties share, they may have been available since ever. So they may be some correlated things that started at the Big Bang and then they just wind up being correlated when you were doing the experiment, and that is going to be the same Bell inequality and you're going to violate it with quantum mechanics. Or if you're a physicist, we believe that the stochastic properties that the parts share are created at the source, because you prepare the source. Like, it's very natural to assume that this is where you're correlating the particles, right? So in more general setups, there might be difficult to get only one source to everybody, and it might be useful to use more than one source. And we believe that the correlations of the particles are at the source, because we're physicists. Like, there cannot be any other some correlated particles if they have never interacted or something like that. And to go to more general models, we would like to study the Markov model of the network, which is like our local decomposition, but we usually assume the independence of the source. And it seems like it's an extra assumption that you're assuming, other than all the things you like, free will, realism, and non-signaling. Other than that, you're assuming more than, like, to say that these things are uncorrelated. But actually, there was a seminal work by Fritz that tells us that this is not an extra assumption. That there's a similar assumption in the Bell scenario, which you have the free will to choose your inputs. So you can preparate a random number generator that is independent of the source, the original source. And that is an assumption you make in the Bell scenario. You can replace that with the ability to preparate independent sources. And there's something famous that's called like the Fritz argument, which you can use independent shared randomness to simulate a bit. And that's why I say that we go beyond the Bell scenario, because we can recover it by these same assumptions. And well, in when you have more than one source and you believe that their stochastic properties are independent, you have a product like this. And this is troublesome, because if you have a product like this, usually before we would only have linear quantities as our inequalities, and now we're going to have, well, non-linear quantities, and actually they're not even convex quantities, which is like the technical way of saying that this set is really, really inconvenient for us to work with for various reasons. And here I give an example of a quantum repeater causal structure, which you can get the inequalities, the BRGPT inequalities, which are square roots of modules. And these things inside the modules are linear combinations of the probabilities of the experiments. And okay, so this is pretty much our framework. And we want to study several causal structures. You may try to arrange them in different manners. And I'm going to I'm going to encapsulate that local decomposition in terms of those drawings that you've been seeing here. Like, usually we assume that lambda is a latent variable, and I'm representing latent variables as triangles. And observable variables that we see in our experiment, I'm representing them as circles. And a natural question we can ask is, well, what other types of causal structures allow for the same things that we can see in Bell's theorem? So we can analyze the same, we can do an analogy of the things we analyze in the Bell scenario and in a general causal network. And well, it turns out that if you allow for different causal structures, we can actually get examples of quantum advantage with fewer latent variables, fewer observable variables than in the Bell scenario. Like in the Bell scenario, you need to have at least two different quantum observables that you're measuring. So you need to have inputs. And if you go to other causal structures, you don't need to have inputs, or you might have communication between the networks. So this is interesting. And there has been a lot of work done in the triangle scenario, which is this one, and a lot of work done in the instrumental scenario as well, where known to have quantum violations. But there's a third causal structure that was not known to have quantum advantage. So, and this is, we were talking about this before, this is a problem that you guys also are aware. And there's no other causal structure. This is important because this was proven by Rob Evans in 2016, that there are actually only 8 equivalence classes for DAGs with 3 random variables. And what I mean by an equivalence class is that, like, the DAGs, the probabilities over the observable variables yield the same conditions. So I gave an example here in this white box, like you have the instrumental scenario, but actually your instrumental variable, observationally, you cannot, like, on observationally, I mean, in the probabilities of passive observation, just P of BC given A, you cannot tell the difference if the influence of A is like a direct influence or some other influence with another latent variable. Because, I mean, you could, this is simple to understand. Like, you could say that lambda is some shared bit and A just outputs lambda, and B is going to get lambda locally and can use it as an input. So it's the same procedure, but I'm not saying the DAGs are the same, but they're equivalent in terms of the probabilities. And the other equivalence class, other than there are 8, 5 of them are trivial, and only 3 of them have latent variables, which are the triangle, the instrumental, and the apps. Okay. Sorry for the long introduction. I just want to make sure that we're talking about the same things. And this is actually the local decomposition of the Evans scenario, which is interesting for the community because it gets 2 main features that are really interesting for the community: independent sources and direct causal influence, like messages between the parts. So it kind of blends them together. So you can see that they're independent sources, but the response function of A depends on the output of B. And apparently it's really hard to get an actual violation of this. So here are our main contributions. First, we prove the non-classicality of a distribution that is reminiscent of a PR box. So we still do not solve its main problem, which is a quantum advantage. And I'm going to get into that. But we prove that there are non-signaling distributions that can violate classical constraints. And our second main contribution is that we introduce new computational tools to analyze the problem of causal compatibility, like to try to find if something is non-classical or not. And I'm going to explain to you guys what is the procedure you have to do to get this non-classicality. So first, this is just the representation of the actual scheme. So you would have to choose one of your sources to be classical and distribute the trit. And they're going to distribute the trit here between A and B. Now A is only going to output lambda deterministically. So this is A's response function. B is going to use lambda as an input to a PR box that is shared between B and C. But this PR box is not the PR box that we're usually accustomed with, like in the standard Bell scenario. This PR box is actually the Bonnet PR box, which is a non-signaling constraint that is very analogous to what an ordinary PR box would look like. But it means that it maximally violates the classical inequalities in the instrumental scenario, okay? And this is what the distribution looks like. It's fairly simple. So we get, we can always see this P of ABC as some P of A and BC given A. And what I'm saying is that this distribution has to be like this. And we have some functions that determine, like, if the input of B is zero, then C outputs zero deterministic, then the function will tell them to output zero. And he's going to sum that with the output data he receives from B. You can see this is a PR box in a standard way. If one just think of B, C is using the output of B as an input. And then if you do this wiring operation, it's basically the same. And we prove this to be actually resistant to white noise, like in uniform distribution. We use inflation first to prove this, but the bounds we get, the things we get in inflation are really low, like the visibilities we get are really high. And we actually introduce new computational tools that use non-convex optimizers to get optimal bounds. So this bound right here, I can, for lower visibilities than 0.84, I can get a classical realization of this. So this is our main, in a nutshell, this is what we prove. Okay, so first, why would we try to use distributions that violate the instrumental on the Evans scenario? That's a good question to ask first. And in the instrumental scenario, there's one really key criteria that's measurement independent. So the instrumental variable A that influences B has to be independent of the common cause. And this means that the de factor and, well, the composition would look like this, which is really similar to the local decomposition, but using B as an input. And then I can always multiply by P of A, and it looks like this. I know I don't have to put P of A inside, but it's useful to see the relation with the Evans. But before the Evans, there's something that can be used to analyze the amount of non-classicality that you might have in a scenario like this, sort of like a quantifier of non-locality. Like, first you consider another DAG. So you consider a DAG that your common cause influences your instrumental variable. I mean, it might seem out of the blue, like, why would I do this? But there are ways to actually argue for this experimentally, like fluctuations in temperature and things like that. So perhaps your settings are not so perfect as we might assume they are. And there might be some influence of your latent variable to your input. And the interesting thing about this is when you have this extra arrow to A, the scenario is saturated. So any probability distribution, local or not, can be realized in this. But what we can do is we can define this function D that is basically the variational distance of the joint distribution and the product of them. So, and we can minimize this function D. I mean, the actual things that that Nikolai Mikling and other authors do to actually minimize this involve a few more complicated things, like approximating this to a higher ever order of linear programs and so on. But you can, in principle, just minimize this function. And if this function is zero, then your distribution will be compatible with the instrumental scenario. Well, if it's larger than zero, then this for sure cannot be compatible with the instrumental. And you can actually quantify this because it goes from zero to one, this function. So you could, and so this is another consequence of that, it's that perhaps you could fix some amount of D, okay? So I don't know, D equals a half. And then you could ask to your program if there exists a distribution in this scenario that realizes some given distribution that you have up until this D to be smaller than or not greater than a desired amount. And actually, you can find quantum violations in such scenarios where you have like a limited measurement dependence. It is possible to violate this with limited measurement dependence. And we use this idea, like this intuition, to talk about the Evans scenario, because you can really see that the arrow from B to A can be interpreted as some type of measurement dependence inside the instrumental scenario. For example, like, because it's the only way, in this arrow B to A is the only way that the variable mu is going to influence A. And of course, they should not factor here in the Evans scenario. And what we can prove, what we can actually say is that if you choose the response function of A to be something like output lambda and just throw away all the information that they receive from B, the decomposition becomes the same as the instrumental scenario. So it's sort of a greater scenario than the instrumental. And this means in mathematical terms that if you have something that's classical in the instrumental scenario, there will have a classical decomposition for it in the Evans. And well, perhaps if we are to have a higher enough violation of the instrumental, could this be non-classical in the Evans as well? Well, this is precisely the case for our distribution that I presented.
Hey, Drew.
And
sorry, can you go back to yes? No, I just wanted to make in the previous slide. Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment and then one question. So the comment is that this final conclusion that every probability distribution that's classically compatible with A is also classically compatible with B. There is another way that you can see this that, I don't know, I find it maybe easier. So in the beginning, do you remember that you put some, you drew some DAGs that were equivalent to the instrumental scenario? So inside the equivalence class of the instrumental scenario, there is one DAG where instead of the arrow between A going to B, you have one common cause between A and B, right? And this is equivalent to the instrumental scenario, but like without arrow. And then you can just look at it and look at the Evans scenario and see that this equivalent graph is just the Evans scenario without one arrow. So it necessarily has to be like strictly weaker than the Evans scenario. So it's just the same thing, but another way to see it. And then the question is, I didn't understand very well what you were trying to do when you did all this measurement dependence and this D of Q. Were you trying to get to this conclusion of, or not Like, what was the conclusion of this measurement dependence part?
The conclusion to the measurement dependence part is actually that the influence from M to A is mediated through B, and it's dependent on the cardinality of B. So something that is non-classical in the Evans scenario would be equivalent in an interpretation sake to say that, okay, it violates the instrumental up until some measurement dependence on B that can be quantified. Like if B is unconstrained, M can just say whatever it wants to A. Actually, this is something that Ellie told me, that in the instrumental scenario, if B is unconstrained, like is an infinite dimensional random variable, then the scenario is already unconstrained. And then by this relation that I of the Evans, that's just the instrumental with another arrow, the Evans will also be unconstrained. But the conclusion to the measurement dependence thing is that if we do not limit the cardinality of B, like limit communication, then this is just a scenario of measurement dependence. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, I think I get it. Thanks.
Can I just speculate? Like, this really is a connection that I hadn't really appreciated so much, but it seems like if you could say that because B mediates all causal connection between the common cause of B and C and A in the Evans scenario, I'm wondering if you could say, like, consider an instrumental incompatible scenario, like a distribution which is incompatible with the instrumental scenario, such as the one which violates the Bonnet inequality. And what you can do is you can say, like, this is not compatible in the instrumental scenario. It's only compatible if the instrumental scenario allows for at least this much measurement dependence. So you can say, like, you need D of this bound to achieve the distribution. But then can you argue that simply by virtue of the cardinality of B being binary, that is not possible to achieve that amount of measurement dependence between A and U? So I'm imagining, take an instrumental scenario distribution with many settings for A, so high cardinality for A, like 3, 4, 5, whatever. Maybe the thing that violates the Bonnet inequality. Like, I don't know whether, like, because I mean, your previous slide said the thing that violates the Bonnet inequality is, in fact, with appropriate weightings on A, incompatible with the Evans. And maybe one way to show that is simply not by virtue of convex optimization, not by virtue of inflation, but by virtue of simply doing these kind of measurement dependence bounds, which is, it requires very high measurement dependence, and that measurement dependence is simply not supported through if it has to go through a bit.
That makes sense. Yeah, what you said makes sense. But that bit has to be the output of B, so perhaps, I don't know if there is some alternative strategy that with measurement dependence and you're mediating it through a bit, because it's like, I understand what you said, okay. And the interpretation of it is pretty much what we were trying to argue. Like what Ellie said, that the appropriate weights, there's actually important, because it seems like I'm using like a Fritz-like distribution to violate the Evans scenario, but that's not actually what happens, because in Fritz-like distributions, we usually just use the violation that we have disguised as the violation of the new network that you're trying to violate. But that doesn't work, because if you symmetrically distribute the inputs, then there's a classical simulation. And then there's a PR box who can be classically simulated in the Evans scenario. What it makes sense, but I just don't know if I can just affirm that, like, without thinking about it, because it's not the same to restrain the cardinality of this dependence and this, but it looks like it's okay, right? So I don't know if I answered your speculation, but I'm sorry.
We can take, I think yes, but we can also talk later. It's cool.
Okay. So, okay, that's nice. A little bit of discussion. So this is the connection to the instrumental. And Now I want to talk a little bit about inflation technique. So I know you guys know all about inflation technique, so I'm not going to make my introductions too long. So usually in inflation technique, we're concerned, it's more like an approach, and you have certain resources that you can pull off in some experiment, and you're concerned with the situation that, well, okay, if I have multiple copies of those resources, what other kinds of experiments I can pull off, and you can be quite creative with this. And something inside the framework of inflation technique is called inflation hierarchy, and it was proposed by Professor Miguel Navasquez and Ellie. And inflation hierarchy tells us that it completely solves the compatibility problem asymptotically. So it's an algorithm that gives higher ever orders of tests that you can do in your computer. And they're very, really simple tests, they're linear programs, and they can tell you if your distribution is compatible or not with a given causal structure. Okay, Julius. I saw Julius raise the hand. You can ask.
Sorry, I didn't switch on my mic. Maybe you misspoke or I misunderstood it, but I don't think the inflation hierarchy is a complete hierarchy.
What I mean is that, okay, perhaps I misspoke on the complete meaning of that word. But what I mean is that asymptotically, you get really, really close to the Coulomb-Black distance is convergent to zero, to the classical set of correlations. If you do n, the n level of the inflation goes to infinity, then you're converging to the classical set. Is that not correct?
I don't know whether I've... I don't know. Again, Ellie's question is correct. Classicalist inflation is a convergent hierarchy, right? But the quantum inflation does not...
Classical.
Yeah. Classical. You're talking about the classical. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I misunderstood.
It's okay. I'm actually showing how we can find incompatibility with the classical set with inflation of this scenario. So I'm using fun outs all around. Okay. So in inflation hierarchy, usually what you have to do is you have some causal structure, you need to turn that into a correlation scenario. So you need to get rid of all the arrows that are not from a latent variable. To do that, they use unpacking. And unpacking is something that is, I can resume, like, these are the conditions for unpacking. And unpacking is only valid for classical probability, for classical correlations here in the Evans scenario, because it has to do with counterfactual definiteness, and this is incompatible with quantum theory. But then you can actually attribute meaningful values to things that have not been measured and consider the full dictionary of, well, when A receives B equals zero, and then it's a random variable, and when it receives B equals one is another random variable, and I can call that just A bar. And now we have a scenario that it's simple, and then we can do this inflation specifically. So I'm using two copies of lambda and three copies of M. And if I only use, like, this is a partial third level inflation, sort of, like, it's not a full, if I do another copy of lambda and some other copies of B and A, then it's a third level inflation. But why do I do only partial third order? Well, because for second order, it gets nothing. And I needed to go a little bit higher, but I couldn't go much higher because of other problems that I'm going to talk about. And this, I believe, is the minimal inflation that you have to use to get incompatibility of that distribution. But there's a problem with this that I'm using in my linear program. and this is a bit technical, I'm not using certificate type constraints. And I think precisely what that means is that I'm marginalizing over non-injectable sets. So I cannot isolate that into the polynomials, monomials into some vector and use Farkas' lemma to derive a witness, which is usually done in linear programming. I need to use conditions like these, which if I wanted to derive a witness, I would have to use some non-linear quantifier elimination technique, which is out of the question because, I mean, the dimensions are really large and this is an NP hard problem in general. So it's usually if we need non-convex, if we need a non-linear quantifier elimination, that's usually bad. So that's a problem. I needed to rank up inflation to third order to try to derive this incompatibility witness and to explore incompatibility in the Evans scenario. And I don't know why second order didn't get anything. That's actually a discussion I had with Eveli a while ago. And we came into an agreement that the cubic monomials were important for some reason. They were important. But then if you try to rank up inflation, there's another problem, which is the computational cost of inflation. So in our violation, A has cardinality 3 and B has cardinality 2 and C as well. If you use inflation, like the standard approach to inflation proposed by Miguel and Ellie, you will get the second level of 20,000 variables in your linear program. And if you go to a third level, you would get about 24 million variables in your linear program. And I mean, don't get me wrong, linear programs are the most efficient things we can solve. And there are no upper limits to the number of variables you can have in one linear program, because usually you can simplify them quite easily. But inflation scales super exponentially in terms of the memory that you need to use. So it scales badly. So it's even for 24 million variables, becomes quite hard to do a linear program. Like we have computational power, but the amount of memory we would need, it's large. So it's difficult to go to higher and higher inflations sometimes. And this is one of the cases. But you can get incompatibility with inflation. And what we propose is actually a trick. So one of the reasons that it scales so badly in this case is because we use unpacking. And okay, unpacking is only valid for classical and it's quite restrictive, so it's good. But what we do is we use a trick that is inspired by e-separation technique, which is something that was proposed again by Rob Evans. And I mean, I think it's obvious why we call it the Evans scenario, but this is why we call it the Evans scenario, because he studied e-separation and all those equivalence classes. And it's usually called the unrelated co-founding scenario, I guess. But we proposed a trick inspired in e-separation technique, when e-separation has to do with node splitting operations. And in a summary, like what you need to do is in the Evans scenario to check e-separation, which stands for extended deseparation. So you want to check the conditional independence in the graph, but there is no unconditional independence in the Evans scenario if you try to use deseparation graphical methods. But you can node split, and then A and C are deseparated. And you can derive inequality conditions from this. So this is a deseparation, but you don't have to. You don't have to check only for deseparation. You can check for any kind of constraints that might arise from this DAG when I consider, instead of a B sending its outcome to A and C, I'm considering another node, a copy of B, that is independently just sending a message to A and C, and B is just outputting something. So I'm breaking the correlation between the message they receive and the output of what? So you can consider just a scenario like this, where if you project B sharp into the same value of B, then you will get your probability distribution. And this is easy to see. And but there's one hiccup, that this is valid for any GPT, because I mean, I can see that as just some local protocol that changes the topology of the network, and I can use that in for any kind of sources. So it's not as restrictive, but it is nice, because if you see the dimensions of this distribution is 24, and the dimensions of the impact one was 72. So if you start with a smaller number of variables, you can rank up inflation a bit higher. And that's what we did. And with this trick, we can retrieve second degree polynomials with a linear program of 2000 variables and 304. And for a third level, we can actually get a linear program with a little bit less than a million variables. And this is doable. So you can rank up inflation to third order, and then find incompatibility, and then find a witness to that incompatibility, which is nice. And I'm going to explain a little bit better about the trick that we proposed. So here we start, this is a more of a graphical explanation. And well, first we assume that the probability distribution on P is classical, and then there exists a classical distribution such like that of A, B, C, and B sharp that recovers P via marginalization. And I think it's not really marginalization. I think I misspoke here, because it's actually more like a conditioning, like just if you choose, if you project your distribution to B sharp equals B. So I'm not actually marginalizing on anything. There, if it's classical here, if P is classical, then exists Q that is classical, then recovers P like that. And this, from this, what we can do is we can proceed to use inflation, because now this looks really like a triangle scenario. And what we do is just use the same procedure, which is a copy of all the latent variables with a small detail that the B sharp, which you can interpret like an observable source between A and C, like some input. We do not use fun outs on B sharp, because B sharp is always a classical variable. Even for non-fun out inflations, I could use fun outs in B. So it's not going to help us, because the thing about inflation is that if you use fun outs, then this Binomial cloning theorem, the quantum sources would not be okay with this kind of procedure. So basically we use node splitting, and then use inflation and extract inflation conditions on the original scenario, the Evans. This was more of a graphical thing. This is the same thing with equations. So if you assume that there is a classical decomposition, then you can construct with those causal parameters, you can construct a Markov model to Q explicitly. And from a Markov model, you can construct a Markov model of any inflation. That's more of the point. So you do inflation, you always have a Markov model that you can construct from the previous one. And I cannot test this Markov model directly, because there are non-convex conditions, but it's quite restrictive and it's quite symmetrical. So I can switch labels like that, and the equation is unchanged. So these are the famous symmetry conditions that one can get from the inflation. So you change labels, and you can change labels even when B sharp equals B sharp two and equals some B sharp, because there are extra symmetries that you can get in those cases as well. And this is an observable variable, so I can do that. And you can actually marginalize to the diagonal variables and project on certain outcomes, and you'll get the quadratic polynomials of the scenario, but with 2000 variables. So we do this for third level, and you can get incompatibility, you can get an inequality, but the visibilities that that inequality allows for violation are really high. So the violation is really, really small. And I didn't put the witness here because it's just a really big cubic polynomial that doesn't really help us understand like what is the intuition behind that. It's just a witness. And our second main contribution is we introduce new computational tools to analyze that. So we can get a violation with inflation, and we can also analyze that with non-convex optimization. And I understand that perhaps not all of you are familiar with like optimization problems in general, something from mathematics that we just usually just use them because they're really useful. But first I wanted to explain to you guys more of a general idea what optimization problems are. So usually in an optimization problem, you want to minimize some function given some constraints that can always be rewritten in like an inequality less or equal than zero. And well, in general, it's really hard to do optimization. Like if you get any function, you can give like some efficient algorithms to find local minimums, solving to the critical points of the function. But usually you cannot find a global maximum or global minimum because it takes some extra effort. And what is so fundamental about convex optimization is that it's the property behind what we can do optimization efficiently. Like usually all convex optimization can be done quite efficiently. And well, a convex function is has this definition, which is like it's like a parabola. Like if you have convex combinations of points that has to be, that cannot exceed the convex combination of the image of those points. And why is it so fundamental to be efficient? Like, why is it so fundamental? Convexity is so fundamental because all local minimums are global minimums if your conditions are convex. So you have efficient methods to find critical points, which is just solving some equation. And you can try to for instance, calculate the gradient of that function and then go in the opposite way and then keep doing that to find some local minimum. And in convex optimization, this finds a global minimum. So that's nice. But there are problems. There are some classes of non-convex problems that still can be optimized, and we introduce some tools that do that. This is the solver that we use, Gurabi, who's actually really good. And just to give you guys an idea of what's happening, so what actually happens in your computer is that, well, you have some convex region like this, and you want to optimize your function in that region. So usually, what they just do is they add tangent cuts. So they can do linear-like relaxations to that feasible set. And you optimize on those tangent cuts. And obviously, you might be not inside the set you want to be because, well, like this. And well, but that's not a problem because if it's outside the set and it's a convex set, then there's a separating hyperplane that I can just add another tangent cut. And then I refine my set and I keep doing that until I find a good enough solution. And those linear-like relaxations are efficient. But then you run into a problem when you consider non-convex sets. So a region like this, where if you do convex combinations, which is like a line, you're gonna go outside the set, and that's a problem. If you add tangent cuts, your tangent cuts might not give you a good enough approximation of the set because it's going to be outside the convex full of that. Like, so, but actually, we might have points like this, and there is no other tangent cut that I can add without going inside the set. So what we need to do is to use a technique called branch and cut. So you branch your convex problem into two regions, and then you convexify both regions, and then you solve the convex problem, both convex problems, and then you compare the solution, and then you can keep doing that to approximate the non-convex set and to find solutions up to a relevant tolerance. Like you can find outer approximations of those convex sets, and you can find inner approximations using other methods, and you can give a reasonable tolerance to give you a confident result. And well, this is really efficiently done for quadratic problems, convex or non-convex. And Burabi does that. So, okay, this is non-convex optimization, but why is that important? Okay, this is non-convex optimization can be used to treat causal compatibility. And to give an example of that for the Avon scenario, we are using this theorem, which is very similar to a fine-like theorem. So a fine-like theorem, it's usually, we usually treat them in the regular Bell scenario. So it basically says that you have a joint probability of all the possible outcomes in your network, so in your Bell scenario. So it's the same as saying that your measurement observables are compatible and you can get a joint distribution on them. So this is sufficient to get a fine-like theorem. But in the Evans scenario, there are analogous theorems that says like, okay, you have a distribution of P of ABC. So what we can do is that you can say that P is classical if and only if there exists a joint probability distributions of A0 to AB. So it's a random variable for each value of B, and the same for C. So a joint distribution of all that, such that it recovers P via marginalization. So if we were to stop here, and Q is a probability distribution, of course. So if we stop here, we have a fine theorem, sort of. But now you need to guarantee the independence of the sources, and you guarantee that by applying saying that these probability distributions of A and C factor. And it's really simple to show this, because if you have a classical decomposition of your distribution, you can just make a product of all the causal parameters, and this is going to be a joint probability distribution on the variables you want. And conversely, well, you can just use that marginalization condition, and you can get an expression like this using this factorization constraint. So they're equivalent concepts, and this, you can ask me, okay, can we do that for any causal network? And no, the answer is no. Actually, you can do it for a specific class of networks, which are called gearable networks. And basically the idea is that you can give all possible outputs that you can have. You can just interpret them as the value of your latent variables. And you can do that sort of it's not like an operation, but like that interpretation. You can say that your random variable are just a list of all the possible outcomes that you have, but that's not always the case. For instance, loop networks, you do not have a finite theorem. They're sort of trivial there, but I can talk about this later. But in the Evans scenario, you have this theorem, and you can pose this as a program, as a non-convex program, because you have these conditions, these quadratic conditions, which do not let the problem be convex. And this is actually a feasibility problem, so I'm not actually maximizing any function. So this is just a notation to say that maximize something that's constant. So the only thing that's going to check if this is an empty set or not. And if it's empty, well, then there is no compatibility. And if it's not empty, then it is compatible, and I can retrieve a local decomposition of the point. And well, you can directly test that for your candidate distribution, which is this one, just so you guys remember. And we can retrieve the previous results, of course, and we can find optimal visibilities. So there's an actual gap that you can find. Of course, this doesn't mean anything. This is because inflation, I could always rank up inflation and retrieve this asymptotically. It is possible to get inequality out of this. Usually feasibility problems, there are some complex analogous theorems to Farkas' lemma. I don't know much about that. So, but there is a simple thing that you can do to find an inequality, that is try to optimize some distance over that point. Like here, I'm using the Euclidean distance, but you can try to find other functions that have this property. Like, since your distribution, your candidate PR box in the case is non-classical, it's never going to be zero, because if it's zero, then P is equal to the PR box. So you can find a good enough distance for your distribution, and you can run that program as well. And this is violated, of course. So this is pretty much what I had to say about the main contributions of the manuscript. And are there any questions so far? Okay. So
just a point of clarification. If you are doing this sort of distance from the point, so like how close can you get over the feasible set, and that's your optimization relative to the quadratic optimizer. Do we have to be concerned about like getting stuck in a local minimum, or can you say like that the quadratic minimizer is reliable, and therefore if this is the minimal distance, you can just treat that as an inequality?
I can treat it as a global optimum because we're using branch and cut.
Nice.
Yeah. But there is a hiccup. Like there is a hiccup if you go to higher degrees, because then perhaps your conditions are too small, because you have powers and powers of numbers. And that might be tricky with numerical difficulties in your program. And for particular that distance, that you can see that the bound is really small. So perhaps if that bound is smaller than the computational tolerance, then this is a problem. So there are these two points. Thanks for the comment. And Julius, you can
yes, again, you said, so the way I understood it, you took a linear program and you had additionally, you know, some quadratic constraints you wanted to enforce, and there is this quadratic optimization program that works for such a problem. Can you do the same when you start with an SDP? Does that matter? Because you talked about non-convex problems and convex problems in general. So does it depend on that? Or is it just, does it just become really hard to solve?
Well, you can always write down your SDP if there are some non-convex conditions that are quadratic in terms of the entries of the matrices. You can always make this trivial mapping and try to tackle that as a really big non-convex problem, for sure. But the SDP formulation, there are a few differences, usually, than, well, a linear program or a non-convex program. Like SDPs are usually convex, and there are other methods that can be more efficient when one considers SDPs. But in principle, if you have like a product of matrices in an SDP that's non-convex, you could try to rewrite that as a non-convex problem. But because of the matrix formulation, perhaps it's going to be a really large problem and it's not going to be efficient. But in principle, you could try to translate one into another. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so this is the first comment. And the comments are, I really like things that caught my attention, and some non-obvious comments that we do not put on the manuscript, but they follow from the things that we put on the manuscript. And I'd like to share with you guys. So this is something tricky because, well, usually the way it was proposed, inflation and the nomenclature with AI expressible and injectable things, it's proposed in a way that you use your objective is to use linear conditions on higher scenarios to your scenarios. So you can use the same tools we developed in Bell-Null locality for networks as well, for any network, and that's great. But if we have more general tools like non-convex optimization, the networks are still non-convex, and quadratic conditions happen naturally when ones are using inflation. But in precise terms, what we would actually need in an inflation to explore non-convex optimization is an AI expressible like set, which is basically unions of ancestrally independent non-injectable sets. So an injectable set is something that you can retrieve with your original scenario. So you have your original scenario, you do an inflation. If the set of variables, the distribution you're considering, is fixed by the original, then this is injectable. And non-injectable are like unknowns in your formulation. And if you have products of unknowns, then you can use non-convex optimization. And I couldn't think of a really smart example to do this with the Evans, mostly because if you can see like Fine's theorem is just using unpacking, so and it converges already. But in the triangle, that's not the case. And if you are interested in, for example, in the triangle with inputs, and you do unpacking, and now you have to do another some inflation of this, naturally the A, B, and C bar now are non-injectable sets, and you're going to have quadratic conditions with second order like inflations from this. So you could, you could use that in the triangle because it's a loop network and there's no fine-like construction for that. Okay. Now, there are some conditions to the bilocal. There are some connections to the bilocal that we can do from the Evans and the bilocal. And one condition is that there is a necessary condition for quantum advantage, and it has to do with the Evans scenario, with the bilocal scenario, sorry. So first, we have to consider a theorem, which I call classical, because, well, if you have some distribution on the Evans that has a classical decomposition, then there must exist a classical distribution on the bilocal scenario such that it retrieves your original distribution when you project X and Z equals B. So if you consider only those entries of your probability distribution, then this has to be equal to the one you had. And they're classical if and only if. And notice that this is only bound in the existence, and this is not necessarily a unique distribution that recovers this. Otherwise, this would be really good, but it's not. The second theorem is the quantum version, that the same relationship happens at a quantum level. So if there is a quantum distribution in the Evans scenario, then there exists a quantum distribution in the bilocal such that if you look only at the entries such that X is equal to Z equal to B, then you're going to have that distribution, the original one. And by combining those conditions, what you can see is that if there exists a quantum but not classical distribution on the Evans scenario, then there must be a distribution on the bilocal that reproduces this quantum distribution. And even though this is only bound on the existence, so there may be infinitely many distributions that can reproduce that, none of them can be classical, because if there is a classical distribution, then by theorem one, our original distribution would be classical, and that's a contradiction. So if there is a quantum advantage in the Evans, we need to be able to see it in the bilocal scenario. And well, that was the first general mapping we had. And well, we could, it's natural to ask, okay, is there some non-local distribution on the bilocal that is explored in literature and several works that could be sufficient? Like, is this condition like sufficient under some specific distribution or some case? But no, we didn't find that. And what we actually found is that a large class of quantum correlations can have a classical explanation in the scenario. So basically, the setup here is that, I think you guys can see the whole screen, right? But the setup here is you have maximally entangled states of dimension D being distributed in the network, and B performs an entangling measurement, a maximally entangled measurement. That is, that the states are given by this. And A and C perform arbitrary POVMs, but they need to have D outcomes. So this is the general setup, and this is what the composition, the quantum decomposition would look like. And if we condition this on B, so if we look at P of AC given B, up to local unitaries, A and C will share a maximally entangled state. So, and since they receive the output, they know which which of the state they share, and they can incorporate that into some of the measurements they're doing. And if we look closely at this, this resembles a source, independent source here of, I'm sorry, a source, quantum source, and some measurements such that they know each other's input, okay? So, and that is independent of the source. So in that case, it was proven a while ago that if you have auxiliary communication in a Bell scenario, what you can do is you can retrieve PR boxes, for instance, because you know each other's inputs, and you can combine them to retrieve non-local correlations. So in fact, the non-signaling polytope, when Bob knows the input of A, is trivial in the sense that it's all can be done by a local decomposition. And furthermore, what you can do is you can partition the set of your latent variables to just say that you have one latent variable that tells A what to do, what to output, and C what to output, and they receive some input that is known by both of them, and you constrain yourself to deterministic strategies. So all the randomness is in this distribution of the latent variables. And well, this is what we get. And what a classical decomposition would look like, it's actually something like this in the scenario. So when I condition on B, even though the sources are independent, you can see as like a Bayesian inversion, like you have two arrows going from the source to B. And if you condition on B, means that B is now sending those arrows to the random variables, and you're correlating the random variables sort of in that way. So it's a probability distribution given B and some deterministic strategies. And if we can directly calculate P of B like this, because we have the measurements of B, and we can choose P of lambda equals P of mi equals 1 over D. And this distribution is the same as the response function of B would be like. So they're unambiguous in that sense. And we choose the distribution, the response function of B to reproduce the distribution Q that we have, like this. So lambda and mu have D values and B has also D values because you can separate them into M and N. And well, that recovers the original distribution if you like to do the calculations. And since gamma zero and gamma one are simply these strategies, we arrange the terms in the response functions to get a classical decomposition. So notice that this is, if we are in the bilocal scenario, there are always measurements that we can choose such that this is non-local. But this is not the case in the Evans. Perhaps this is why it's so difficult to find from bilocal. My second comment would be on the parallel prepare measure scenario. So what do I mean by this? In the Evans scenario, we have communication. And there are scenarios with communication that are proposed. And usually in those scenarios, we can vary the quantum set in several different ways. Like you can consider instead of a classical message, you can send a quantum system of some cardinality given the dimension of its Hilbert space. So, and you can also use entanglement assistance with that. So there are all kinds of zoos of sets that you can define because they are dependent on the dimension and the cardinalities of those variables. And there are these prepare and measure scenarios are building blocks of any communication task. And we can, it's natural to ask, well, can we find other communication tasks with other networks? And well, it happens that the Evans scenario is the simplest communication task that is not a prepare and measure. And what we could do is to consider other variations of the quantum set. Like, for instance, we can consider an entangling message of Bob sent preparing a quantum state and distributing them to A and C. And of course, there are some dense coding protocols if one considers entanglement shared between the parts. But even the question with shared randomness is a little bit intriguing because, I mean, in standard prepare and measure scenarios, when you do not have an input for Bob, so you just have an instrumental scenario, there is no difference if you consider a quantum message or a classical message. That's Frankenwerner's theorem that states that. So there's no advantage only using quantum messages. You need to have some entanglement assistance. But in the Evans scenario, you may have entanglement between the parts. And this is naturally linked with some ambiguous state discrimination protocols where perhaps you can look at it as, oh, so just so you guys can see, I think you guys have seen the images, but I mean, this is the classical decomposition. So it's like the Evans scenario, but I am marginalizing over the message. And this would be when quantum sources and quantum messages are considered. So Bob is doing a CPTP map on the shares of quantum systems they get, and they are doing measurements on those states after. And I'm talking about this classical sources and quantum messages. So this would be the decomposition. You have some strategies that are being distributed here. Bob prepares some quantum state with those strategies. And given this strategy, you can prepare a measurement. And what is actually linked with ambiguous state discrimination is that, okay, if you consider fixed mu, and so A does not know mu. If you consider fixed mu between C and B, it means that every value of lambda, B can prepare have cardinality of lambda different states. And C will try to discriminate between those states that may be non-orthogonal to each other. And this is symmetrical to the other part. So what so happens that it looks like a simultaneous state discrimination strategy, and you're trying to communicate the parts with that quantum state. So, I mean, I'm just commenting that because it's not obvious to me that this is going to have a classical decomposition always, because I'm restricting the cardinality of B, right? B is a message that I'm interested in limited communication. So it's not obvious. Going on. So the last thing we do is derive theory independent constraints. So this was already noticed in the seminal work by Eli Speckens and Tobias Fritz, that non-Fanout inflations will yield conditions for quantum theory and for any GPTs that you might consider. And more recently, Professor Gizan and some collaborators noticed that this is actually really, really connected with the concept of non-signaling in networks. So in the Bell scenario, usually non-signaling has to do with your input cannot influence your y, x has to be independent from y. So this is basically what you do in non-signaling, and you use those linear conditions. But what they notice is that, well, when you have some network, even though they might not have inputs, they might choose to do the input or not. And what do I mean by not doing the input? Why? I mean, instead of doing an input, he could buy some other sources and some other measurement devices and locally modify the topology of the network. And now this, of course, will link to all non-Fanout inflations, because that's pretty much what you're doing. And you cannot do Fanouts because usually one might have post-quantum resources or post-classical resources. But they do constrained the set. So what I'm trying to say is that this can be seen, the GPT, which is compatible with all non-Fanout inflations, can be seen as like a generalization of the non-signaling concept that also assumes independent of the dependence of the sources. And we can do that in the Evans scenario. So we can first do node splitting, which is valid for any GPT. And there's actually conditions one can impose, and like entropic conditions to this DAG alone, but you don't have to stop at that DAG. You can do a non-Fanout inflation of that as well. And well, I'm using Fanouts, but I'm using Fanouts on inputs, so that's okay. And I'm getting copies of the latent variables, and we can actually get witness of that. And by testing this distribution, which is was noticed by Evans, and it's the hallmark of incompatibility in the scenario, because here you can see that there's only B equals zero, so A, B, C, right? And there's only B equals zero, so B is deterministic. Nevertheless, A and C are perfectly correlated. So for the Bell scenario, for the Evans scenario, which B is the only thing that correlates and C, it doesn't make any sense. So it's incompatible in a very strong sense, because if you violate, if you violate those conditions, means that there's no GPT that you could have come from. So it's not physical in that sense. And it has a good enough visibility, this distribution. So you can get like 0.7 from this inequality. And one thing that Professor Gizan and the collaborators do when they derive these constraints for the triangle scenario is that they find constraints that are not satisfied by the models they try, the classical models they try. Much of them are satisfied, but there's some region there that they don't know. And there might be some minimal example of quantum locality in the 222 scenario of the triangle. And there is something similar we can conjecture, I guess, and the Evans scenario. And this cannot be conjectured in the instrumental, because there's no GPT advantage for when all variables are binary. So there could be some minimal examples of non-locality. They were explored recently in many different studies of the triangle from people in Geneva. And well, we can use non-convex optimizers to find the optimal visibility of that distribution I showed you guys, this one, to classical models. So it's actually 1/3. The highest visibility you can get is 1/3. And I can get from that program an inequality. And this inequality, it's a little bit different from the one I showed, because it's not a distance of anything. What actually we do is we have several conditions, and then we just throw some conditions out. And if the remaining program is still unfeasible, so if we still find incompatibility only with a subset of conditions, that program is still really good. So you can keep that, and those conditions were not important. And you can do that and find a subset of conditions and use nonlinear quantifier elimination, which is just some algebraic manipulations in the end. So you can get this inequality from that procedure with the scenario where all the variables are binary. And you can get a witness for this visibility. And well, there's a whole gap here, and it's natural to ask, could quantum mechanics give us anything inside here, or any GPT for that matter, that would be a minimal example of advantage of null locality. And this is my last comment. I know I'm way ahead of time. And the first thing, there's a disclaimer, and there's a lot one needs to study to say something meaningful about this. And what I actually mean is that there's a lot I need to study to say something meaningful about this, but I'm gonna try it anyway. There are some simple arguments that I can use to explain my intuition, which I'm going to try to ask of the connections of causal inference in quantum error correction. So there's something that I learned from Professor Arthur Eckert in one of his courses on quantum computation, that he says that computation is a physical process. Computation is a physical process. And like after the third time, it sticks with you. And this is really important because from the point of view, information is physical, right? And it's really natural to ask how those variables correlate with each other in an error correction test. But this is sort of a hand-waving thing, but there are some simple arguments you can give, like every error correction strategy that you have some encoder, some guy that has information, thus a physical system, and wants to send that information to another person, which is the decoder. And to do efficient quantum error correction means that they can retrieve that information and they can communicate with themselves efficiently. And there are errors that might happen when transmitting that that information that you cannot control. So what you're actually talking about is that there's a high probability that they can retrieve that perfectly. Or perhaps the probability is one, if depending on the case. And the second argument, so the thing is to interpret error correction as a communication task between parts. And the information is always transmitted through physical systems, and the operations are not perfect. So you have some input of information, but there might be some random bit flips that happen, and you do not know which output you have. You only know the probability of that output, which has to do with the probability of the bit flip. And you can actually try to explain that through response functions of input bits and output bits. And in error correction theory already, there exists something that's called network coding, which they define a multicast scenario, which is basically you have a message and you want to send to several receivers. And network coding is, instead of forwarding messages, which is what we usually do, we just get that information and put that into a channel. It's better actually to do linear combinations of that information and then transmit that. And the most prominent example of multicast scenarios in error correction theory are the butterfly network, which you have some message. So what's actually, instead of sending the message, you separate that message. You do an operation in A and B, so a cloning. Then you sum them up. Then you do an operation again, cloning them. Oh, sorry. And you give that to two receivers that can retrieve A and B. So I had an information AB, and now the receivers in the end have AB. And this is really studied in the literature of error correction. And in fact, if you only consider the two-bit maps that they do, using this interpretation that they can have input bits and output bits and response functions, and the sources that distribute are also not perfect, so they can have some probability of bit flip and so on. This is pretty much the Evans scenario. And well, I thought that was interesting because my first question was, what is the quantum version of this? Like, we would need to consider all quantum nodes and quantum sources and CPTP maps all around. And we would have to address that the successfulness of our error correction code, which in the classical case would be given by, well, how much you can perfectly correlate the end nodes or some success probability now in terms of fidelity of the quantum information you want to consider. But there is some literature on this already on network coding, but the main goal of the comment is like to ask, is there a fundamental connection between, well, causal inference and error correction? And could this bring new insight to quantum error correction using quantum networks and inflation techniques and so on? So this is a summary of my talk. So I have a summary of the paper. Provide non-classicality for the Evans. We introduce new computational tools. We show negative results. And on quantum and post-quantum candidates, so post-quantum is that PR box that I told you guys that we can classically do. And we derive topological constraints for the Evans scenario. And these are the comments that we can combine in principle inflation with non-convex optimization. We could explore minimal examples of non-locality and in the Evans, but we cannot prove if they are actually minimal examples. New scenarios can be considered when one allows for communication between parts in a network and quantum communication and that kind of stuff. And Bayesian networks can model error correction in multicast scenarios in a classical case. And what would be the quantum version of a network quantum coding, something like that. So thank you guys. Sorry for taking too much time of your time, but this is it.
Thank you. That was great. There's definitely a lot to digest there. So we'll take questions. You can raise your hand if there's a queue and jump in if not. So Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. I had a question about, there was a slide where you were talking about the connection between the Evans scenario and the bilocality scenario. And, you know, if you can find the right kind of quantum classical gap in bilocality, then that would imply a quantum classical gap in Evans. So let me just, I think I've understood the situation here because it's analogous to the connection between the Bell scenario and the instrumental scenario, that I can think of the instrumental scenario as like a Bell scenario where Alice's setting and Bob's outcome happen to take the same value. Like the distributions in the Bell where they happen to take the same value are distributions you can see in the instrumental scenario. Now in that example, you know, we know that there are these quantum classical gaps in the instrumental scenario if the cardinalities are right, you know. And then you just have to check that, okay, if I look into the kind of subspace of the distributions where that condition of the setting and the outcome being equal, you know, is satisfied, you know, does the gap still survive in that region of the space of distributions? So I guess I'm, first of all, am I sort of imagining what you've done correctly? That you're sort of like looking into those projections of the known quantum classical gaps in the bilocality scenario and asking whether any of those known gaps survive under that projection? That's my first question. Have I got that right? And the second question is, you know, we know from the instrumental scenario that, you know, the cardinalities of the variables might be important. So I guess I'm wondering, to what extent have you looked at, you know, higher cardinalities of variables in the bilocality scenario to sort of try to find a gap there? You're muted, so I don't know if you're...
I'm sorry. Okay, so we did explore known quantum gaps in the biolocal scenario and try to see if that gap survives without success. And we tried with different cardinalities of the variables, but there is a hiccup that for this mapping to work, the cardinality of X and Z have to be equal to the cardinality of B, right? And if you and if you're trying to get, like, for instance, violations of the elegant joint measurement in the bilocal, you need more, you might need more outcome, more inputs on your network. And this unavoidably ranks up the cardinality of B. And if you're ranking up the cardinality of B, the intuition is that this becomes harder to violate because now B has a lot of power in the network. So we, the cardinalities are really important, but we could not find any examples such that like we could try to find the higher cardinalities of X and B still a bit.
That makes sense.
We just, okay. And what was the next question? Sorry, the second question?
Well, the first question, you've answered the second question. The first question was just, have I got it right that you're sort of taking what we know about quantum classical gaps in bilocality and then, you know, projecting into the space of distributions where X and B and Y all take the same value and asking if that gap is still apparent. That's what you're doing, yes? Okay, thanks. That's
exactly what we're doing. Yeah, sorry, thank you.
Okay, good.
So Julius,
I don't know. It's me again. So just so that I understand the high level idea, you take a scenario, for example, the Evans scenario, where you can't a priori, you know, formulate conditional independencies. Then you apply an inflation to the network such that the resulting inflated structure allows you to formulate conditional independences. And then you solve that with a quadratic program. Is that correct? Do I understand your approach correctly?
Well, we don't actually use inflation to use non-convex optimizers. In the work, we sort of use them as like alternative ways. And then the comment that I made that we can use them together is just that that doesn't have to be the case. But first we first use some inflation and then use inflation again. And then what we use in non-convex optimization is just this theorem that I wouldn't say it's an inflation because I could say it's an unpacking of the scenario. It's precisely this scenario. Okay. And then you can apply non-convex optimization to this.
So the unpack.
Yes, but you
basically transform the structure where you can't formulate conditional independence into a structure where you can by unpacking or by inflation. It's the same thing.
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess I had a question on this idea of exploiting e-separation to reduce the computational complexity. I think this is exactly the slide I wanted to ask about. You've got this any GPT graph where you've done the node splitting.
Sorry.
No, you were right there. Like the you didn't have to move slides, like the one that you had previously was good.
Sorry. It's this one.
Yeah, right there. So there's the bottom left graph has the node split B and B sharp. We can say like, okay, if we can assess causal compatibility to this, we're basically done. And then you want to do inflation on that. it seems to me like you're not just doing inflation with standard unpacking on this, because then you'd still have this B sharp variable, which is a parent of A and C. And so you'd still need to unpack A and C because they still have a classical parent. So you're not doing quite unpacking. You're doing something different. You're taking independent copies of the sources. And I guess my question is, on this graph where you now have many versions of A and many versions of C and many versions of the original variable B, do you still have only one B sharp, which is sort of like the parent that you think of, which is connected to all of the A's and all the C's?
That's a good question. You're right that I could consider a B that is parent of everyone, right? Like just do a lot of unpackings. But then there's a problem that you cannot retrieve the polynomials correctly. Like this is going to be a hiccup when you're trying to get these conditions right here. If B is a parent of everyone and you have to condition B sharp, then every B11, B22 has to be equal in the product. So to circumvent that, what we do is we consider independent copies of B sharp, so just that we can control those polynomials, those monomials independently. Does that answer your question?
It does. And then I'm wondering, is like there an art form here to how you're choosing where to break B sharp up? Because it seems, for example, here that the different versions of B sharp, what you call B sharp 1 and B sharp 2, are sort of matching, they're sort of tracking C. And so they're kind of tracking M1 and M2.
Yeah.
So you're saying we're going to basically have this latent variable M1 or M. And every time we take copies of M, that particular source, we're going to take copies of B with it or B sharp with it. And I'm just kind of wondering like how you, that's just heuristic, you chose to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, that's precisely, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it was just commenting that this is, we for each A and C, like A, I, C, I, we give, a BI to them, so they can have their own classical source, observable classical source, whatever.
One for every
two of the, because I need to get n copies of lambda and n copies of mu, and for each of those copies, there is only one copy of A and C corresponding to them, because they're only parents of one A, and then it means there's only one index indexizing A and C copies. And then I give a B to that.
Gotcha. So these are like the diagonal ones. Understood. Okay, got it.
Something that I did not mention, but perhaps it's relevant because it has to do with the question that you were asking, is that usually in the definition of an inflation, what you want is that locally, your causal structure remains the same. So the ancestral subdag of a particular variable has to be the same. And this is not the case in this inflation technique with node splitting, because essentially A is not an injectable set. Like the causal structure, the subdag is different, but the parenthood of the variable is the same. So perhaps this is why we have to sort of do this trick in this particular way.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree that if you do sort of like this node splitting approach to inflation, then you have to sort of be careful about what's an injectable set or not. And I do think, however, that you could probably have gotten away with just one B sharp, because you would just have your expressible sets, not using AI expressibility, but using expressibility in terms of conditional variables. So you could do it, but then you would get inequalities which would not necessarily just be polynomials. You'd have to involve conditioning.
Okay.
If you look at the the inequality that you computed for all GPTs, you'll notice that all of the terms in that polynomial, it's like, I don't know, 10 slides further down, have B taking the value zero in all of the quadratic terms.
Yes.
And so you could just basically divide everything there by the marginal probability of B being equal to zero squared. And then you just convert everything into conditionals and it's, you know, fine. And the point is, you could then simply do this without considering, you know, you don't have one B sharp for this AC, one B sharp for that AC. The whole point is you just have one B sharp, and that's why you're sort of getting these inequalities, which are all conditional on a single value of B sharp. So you could play this game also with fan out inflation, and you'd get something. But okay,
no, makes sense.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Okay, so then let's just thank you once more. I really appreciate it.